This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 338 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is Rob Mark, aviation journalist and publisher of the Jetwine blog.
Hey, well, good evening to everybody from beautiful downtown Chicago. Normally I might say something about the weather, but I think we should just get right on to introducing our guest who's had quite a week of ugly weather.
Oh, so many of us have. Yes, our guest this episode is Trevis Gardner. Now, Trevis is an accredited airport executive, and he's also vice president of operations with the Metropolitan Knoxville Airport Authority. Trevis, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hey, good evening, guys. Thanks for the warm welcome. It has been a cold week in most of the state of Tennessee.
Oh, absolutely. And coming up when we have our conversation with you, one of the things I'd like to talk about is how weather impacts airports and how you manage through some difficult situations sometimes. But let's talk about just quickly, you operate the McGee Tyson Airport that's outside of Knoxville, Tennessee.
That's correct. I work for the Metropolitan Knoxville Airport Authority, and we are the airport management entity. We're a government entity in East Tennessee, and we operate two airports in the Knoxville area, McGee Tyson Airport, which is an air carrier airport. It's also a joint-use military facility, as well as something that's near and dear to the hearts of many of the air Plane Geeks listeners, a general aviation airport, and along with getting to manage that airport downtown Island, I get to be the FBO manager in addition to all the other stuff at the air carrier airport.
Oh, well, and on top of all that, we've learned that you're actually a longtime Airplane Geeks listener, aren't you?
I have been listening to Airplane Geeks, I think, 8 or 9 years, maybe even longer. I kind of have to turn back and remember what kind of phone I had at the time. And I think I was actually listening to Airplane Geeks back on an old black and white screen BlackBerry.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, it's also evidence that if you listen to us long enough, you may end up as a guest. All right. Coming up, we've got some aviation news from the past week to talk about. Then we're going to talk with Trevis about some of the airport operations that he's responsible for and learn some interesting things about those and some activities that are going on. We've also got, we plan to have David Vanderhoof jump in a little while and give us a movie of the month report. So we're looking forward to seeing David, or to hearing David anyway. We've also got an aviation minute from Rob. We have an Australia Desk report talking about the upcoming Avalon Air Show, also the Red Bull Air Race news. And, of course, we've got some listener feedback, maybe even a listener recording if we can manage to end up with enough time for that. But since we've got a full schedule, why don't we get started right away with the aviation news? Are you guys ready?
Well, ready.
Ready, yeah.
Our first story comes from Travel Agent Central. This is JetBlue to increase charter service to Cuba. Now, JetBlue, they recently announced plans to increase their charter services to Cuba using an A320 aircraft. This is kind of the first major carrier to make an announcement about increasing flights to Cuba. This has been an interesting topic because obviously Cuba has suffered, I guess, under an embargo by the United States, which has limited travel to Cuba by U.S. citizens. In fact, most of the travel, if not all the travel, I guess, has been through charter companies as opposed to regularly scheduled mainline aircraft. Is that how you understand it, Rob?
It is how I understand it, but then my understanding of it does not necessarily mean it's the only understanding of it. But I think the more important thing here is to say, oh, it's about time. Holy smokes. How long have we had the restrictions in there against Cuba? I don't know, 50 years?
I think we go back to the 60s, right, with the Cuban Missile Crisis and all of that.
You know, and one side would say it's time to open it up. The other side would say that, you know, the Castro regime has never been kind to the Cuban people, and so any kind of normalization only makes it worse. I don't know. You know, me, I'm kind of a practical guy. I guess I'd say that after whatever you've been doing for 50 years, if you look back on it, it hasn't changed anything. Probably time to try something else. And so I'm kind of glad to see that, you know, that there's going to be a little freer travel to Cuba.
Well, as an airport manager, I'm encouraged that this could be a shot in the arm for some of the secondary markets in the Southeast. There's a number of airports that have made a pretty good investment in adding Federal Inspection Service for international travel to their airports, but they haven't seen expansion in their traffic. So there may be some smaller airports that are able to expand their air service to include Cuba.
Yeah, interesting. I imagine that the demand for that is likely to increase if the U.S. does, in fact, sort of loosen up some of the restrictions. There's some interesting resources concerning travel to Cuba. I find that there's about six, about half a dozen charter operators operating flights to Cuba. ABC Charters is one. I think that that's one of the partners that JetBlue has in this sort of expansion endeavor. There's Airline Brokers Company. They use the Sky King, and they support JetBlue also with flights to Cuba. And they have an interesting Cuba travel Q&A page that we'll put a link in the show notes that describes kind of what the scenarios are now that you can travel under to Cuba. And it mentions that there's 12 allowable categories for travel. That includes things like for professional research, educational activities, people-to-people exchanges, humanitarian purposes, family visits, and some others. But interestingly, tourism is not one of the allowable reasons for U.S. citizens to travel to Cuba. But maybe we will see that opening up as a result of the administration's actions to kind of change the situation some. But yeah, I think that'd be great.
You know why tourism's not in there?
Why is that, Rob?
Because in the dictionaries that the feds use in Washington, there is no listing for the word fun. So they just it's just not in their vocabulary.
Tourism
or cigars.
Or cigars. Right. And cigars aren't there either. Right. Thank you for that.
All right. Well, I like your point, Travis, that this may open up opportunities for for airports and for operators to begin flights. I imagine that, yeah, there would be quite a demand for that that kind of travel. Our next story. This comes from Fox News. Actually, this is Emirates Airline rejects Delta apology over Chief's 9/11 comment. American, United, and Delta, they claim that since 2004, the Gulf carriers have received more than $40 billion in government subsidies. And they say that's unfair. And they're asking the U.S. government to either renegotiate or kill treaties that have allowed Qatar and United Arab Emirates Airlines to increase the number of flights to the U.S. Now, recently, the CEO of Delta Airlines, Richard Anderson, he talked to CNN about claims that bankruptcy protection amount to government assistance. So this is kind of coming from the other side. And Rob, it kind of got him in some hot water.
Well, it wasn't just the bankruptcy claim. I don't quite know all the details of how Mr. Anderson was commenting on some of these subsidy issues, but I think one of the claims also from the Middle East was that, of course, the American government gave the airlines $5 billion right after 9/11. And that was questioned. And this is what the quote from Mr. Anderson was supposed to be, essentially, that he couldn't understand how those people, meaning the folks in the Middle East, could be upset considering the fact that the terrorists from 9/11 came from the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. And the folks in the Middle East were not real happy about that. And so, of course, Delta did some really fast talking there and said, no, that's not what he was talking about. He really meant he couldn't understand how they were questioning the $5 billion. So now, I wasn't there. None of us were. That's simply what was reported. But Delta had to do some fast backstepping, and apparently it didn't make a whole lot of difference to the Emirates or Qatar or any of those others, because let's be serious. Those are not just little dinky regional airlines anymore.
Right.
They are becoming major, major players in the world airline industry. And when you can have a CEO from Delta saying something, you can have the folks from Emirates saying, nah, I'm not buying that. And people listen.
You know, some aspects of this remind me of the difficulties between Boeing and Airbus that come up, all the time, it seems. Claims and counterclaims about subsidies from, their respective governments of one form or another. And this sounds kind of similar in that, the U.S. is saying that the Gulf carriers get government assistance and the Gulf carriers saying, well, when you get bankruptcy protection, that's also government assistance of a sort. And, of course, it goes back and forth and no one's ever going to agree one way or the other. I don't know if there's a resolution to that. It's just sort of different perspectives. Yeah, maybe.
Well, but there is this comment. See, it's certainly about the subsidies, and you're right. This is, to me at least, exactly what Airbus and Boeing have been arguing for a decade or more. But there is this comment that Mr. Anderson made, and that really inflamed the situation. It kind of took things to a whole new level. Mm. So I think we're kind of talking about two subjects here, not just the subsidy one. But
yes.
I think the folks at Delta right now are just kind of hoping this will all just go away.
Yeah. What else can they do, I think that's...
Not much.
Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of Emirates, we see in Biz Journals an article, a huge Boeing 747 order, unlikely but possible. Now, this is about maybe an Emirates order for 100 747-8s, and it comes from unnamed sources. I always worry about these unnamed sources, but they say someone, not Boeing, is pitching the 747 to Emirates.
That's a lot of aluminum.
That is a lot of aluminum. Of course, Emirates has a lot of aluminum. They don't have any 747s. They've got some A330s that they're going to retire. They've got some A340s that they're going to retire. And the rest of the fleet is all 777s, a lot of them, and around 150 in round numbers, and currently I think around a little under 60 Airbus A380s. They've got a lot of aluminum, and they may be looking for more, but it's kind of curious as to the 747-8.
Yeah, it is to me too, actually, because of course the 747-8 has not been real popular. It's a four-engine airplane. It doesn't have the I don't think it has the range. See, we need Dan here for this. I don't believe it has the range of the A380, but it certainly won't carry as many people as the A380. So it's a great airplane. It just hasn't quite found its spot in the world, and I forgot how many they've sold, but it's not many. I'm sure the folks at Boeing are saying, oh, please, please make this happen.
Well, there's another perspective, too. And I saw this one reported from our friend Richard Abulafia from the Teal Group. And he made a comment that, you know, he's heard this stuff before, but maybe this is really all about the A380neo. Now, there is no A380neo right now. The desire of Emirates is to re-engine the A380 with newer technology engines. Of course, you're talking about a big airplane that's sold in relatively small numbers. The cost to re-engine that is, well, you know, it's kind of difficult to say if the economics work. But we have seen in the end of last year, in December 2014, it was reported in Aviation Week that Airbus is thinking about an A380neo and has been talking with Rolls-Royce about creating an engine or modifying an engine for that mission. So it's, you know, these things are always kind of, you know, complicated and interesting, and there's a lot of intrigue and a lot of politics, and this talk about a 747 may just be something that is designed to pressure Airbus into moving ahead with an A380neo. It's, you know, it's hard to say what's really going on.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a toughie for Airbus. I mean, they are not even close to making money on the first group of A380s that they created, especially with all the production issues they had at the last minute. But to take on a whole nother version of that, wow, that's hard to understand, because there's not that many customers out there for them. So what's going to happen to the old ones? A used A380, even with the old engine technology, I don't see that as being an airplane that, say, United or Delta or American are just sitting there saying, oh, yes, let's go pick them up in a fire sale, you know, or something. I just don't see it happening. But again, I guess we'll find out. But you would know better than I, Max. I mean, but to do a re-engineering project on any airplane of that category, we're talking in the billions, I would think, even just for re-engineering, aren't we?
Yeah, typically you can use a rule of thumb about $1 billion to do a re-engine like that. And the other point of this is that, you know, when you look at the A380 market out there, Emirates has half of the aircraft. The A380 is like the airplane of Emirates, pretty much. You know, half of the entire fleet being operated by one carrier is, well, I don't think there's anything else like that or even close to it. So Emirates does have a lot of pull with the OEMs in terms of the A380, but it's tough. You have to look and see what the future is, what the future market looks like, and is it really just Emirates, or are there some other, you know, big players out there, big buyers out there that would justify this?
Well, but you know, one thing we have to keep in mind is that what makes the A380 different from the other aircraft is that even if another company picks them up, they're restricted as to where they can go. I mean, Travis, you can certainly speak to the efforts that it would take to make an airport ready for an A380. Did you guys ever have that kind of a discussion down there at your place?
Yeah, for an airport our side, given the traffic, we only do about 1 million in plane passengers a year. So it would not be economically viable. There would have to be some other compelling need. The horizontal geometry of an airfield layout is guided by the FAA into what's called design groups. And the higher the design group, you move from A to B to C to D, it becomes terribly expensive. And it's mostly talking about the configuration of the turns from a taxiway onto a runway, the main gear on an A380 is so far apart, it has a much larger turning radius. And so the civil engineering impact of installing pavement systems just to accommodate a few aircraft, the payback, the return on investment is a long, long time unless you operate a lot of A380s in and out of a given airport.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And when an airport has to make changes like that in order to accommodate changes in the fleet that flies in there, whether it's an A380 or something else, who funds that? Does the airport pay for those infrastructure changes?
Typically, keep in mind the airfield improvements are the largest capital investment at an airport. You know, there's kind of the big three of expense items at an airport, and one is the airfield. Obviously, if you don't have a runway, you don't have an airport. And one of my favorite quotes is, "The runway is the most important street in any town." And
I like that.
Yeah. So the primary funding for most airports. Now, there's some different configurations when you get into the CADX airports, like at Atlanta and ORD and LAX. There's the funding is of a different nature, simply because of the sheer volume of passengers. But 75 of the top 100 airports in the nation rely on what's called AIP funds, or Airport Improvement Program. And those are federal funds dispensed by the FAA through their regional administrators. And those are collected off of the tax on aviation fuel. So the...
Yes.
Yeah. So that's where those large capital dollars come from for capital improvements in an airport. And those are generally... any sort of airfield infrastructure, runway, taxiway, nav aids, terminal ramps, RF equipment, any kind of safety or direct aviation-related capital expense goes into that category. So most airports, if there was a compelling need, you know, if you had leases and operating agreements with some airlines and they wanted to bring A380s, it would literally take probably a couple of years of planning and I'm going to say 2 to 4 years worth of construction just to move from, I think A380, I can't remember the design group off the top of my head, but to make that big leap in taxiway geometry would be a significant investment.
Hmm. That fund you mentioned, isn't that the fund that there's been some conversation in the past over whether it is protected enough from being diverted to other government uses?
Yeah, that's a great point. The AIP funding mechanism grew out of actually the transition from the old CAB, the Civil Aeronautics Board. Had a similar funding mechanism, and it was called ADAP, which was Airport Development and Programming, or I don't remember the exact acronym. And it was rebirthed in the mid-80s, I believe, as the modern thing that we know as AIP. And so the legislators that had the vision for funding the nation's transportation infrastructure, air transportation, I should say, envisioned a three-year block or a three-year authorization whereas Congress would allocate funds into the AIP program on a three-year block. And that would give both the regional FAA administrators and the airport partners the chance to do programming and funding that would bridge construction seasons. Is one of the driving reasons.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because you need to be, if you're going to install a new taxiway or a new ILS system or something of that nature, you need to be able to design it, and that might take 1 year or 2 years, 3 years perhaps. And then you have to after you have those specifications and plans, you want to bid it so that you've got multiple contractors that want to compete for that funding. You bid it and then you award it, and it may be, depends on the region. Up north, you may have a very closely, tightly compressed construction season of maybe just 90 or 120 days. And so you'd need that 3 year time frame to program and execute that. Well, AIP, I've lost count. I think we're on our 17th continuing resolution. So we're living
wow,
17 years of a 1 year extension on a 3 year program, and so it makes it challenging for both the FAA administrators who are trusted to dispense those funds to the airport, as well as the airports to cope with planning a year at a time rather than 3 years at a time for those capital funds.
Yeah, fascinating. You know, I think if I was going to do my aviation career all over again, Rob, being an engine guy was pretty exciting. But if I had to pick something else, I think maybe getting into the airport biz would be just a fascinating, fascinating career.
Well, if you can't earn an honest living in engines, you could always think about becoming an airport manager.
Heck yes.
I was going to say, well, I know we could talk about other, maybe we can talk about some other funding things I was going to bring up too when we got to Travis's segment there in a little bit. So I'll save it for that.
Okay. All right. Well, in the meantime, let's talk about the pilot shortage. Now, this is something that comes up all the time. We've talked about it a lot. Rob's talked about it in the Aviation Minute. And Aviation Week has an article on the topic and also in their podcast. I don't know if y'all are familiar with Aviation Week has a podcast. It's called the Check Six Podcast, weekly. Relatively brief, not as long as this one.
Nothing is as long as this one.
Well, there are a few, but it was a topic of the Check Six podcast recently as well. The way I look at it is that we have this age 85 mandated retirement for pilots in the
85?
U.S.
85?
Oh, not 85, 65.
65. I was going to say, man, if they can make it to 85, boy, that's going to be incredible.
Even my wife over there is looking at me like she's like, I'm crazy. Yeah, 65, sorry. So you have that, and that's going to drain out a large number of pilots. You've got fewer military pilots available these days to draw upon. And then you've got these low but somewhat improving regional pilot salaries. The majors are drawing on the regionals for pilots, and fewer students are entering aviation colleges, for example, looking for a commercial pilot career, in part because the regional salaries are so low. I mean, that's how I kind of characterize this. And I think Aviation Week is saying that, yeah, that's kind of the dynamic that's going on. It's going to be a problem, although the effects are different in different regions of the world.
Well, I have actually just two things to say about this.
Okay.
One, there absolutely is a pilot shortage. And two, there's no pilot shortage at all.
Because okay. Care to elaborate, Rob?
Yeah. Oh, what a good idea. Yes. Well, you know, if you listen to the Airline Pilots Association, they will tell you there is no shortage of pilots. There are pilots out there that are on furlough that would love to go work if they could. And yet you will find regional airlines that are saying we can't get enough bodies. And now we're really getting worried because as the majors suck more and more of their crews, they're actually at a point where they're starting to cancel flights and airplanes are sitting on the ground.
Right.
So how can this be, you may ask?
Rob, so, how can this be?
Yes, what a good question, Max. I think it's semantics. I really do. If you listen to the Airline Pilots Association's debate about this, they will tell you there is no shortage of qualified pilots. And the airlines are saying we can't get enough pilots, period. Well, we all know, and in fact, I just did something about this week ago or 2 weeks ago about why the regional airline pay is so lousy. But the point is that there are a lot of guys that are airline. I'm sorry, guys. I mean that generically, ladies and men. That are out there on furlough, that are well qualified, that could be in the left seat or the right seat of any of these regional airliners, but they will not work for the kind of wages that the regional airlines want to pay. So they're saying, I'm not going to work there. So are they qualified pilots? Yes. Are they? Does that mean that there are no pilots out there? Of course not. These guys could work, but they won't for those wages. And the airlines are saying, well, this is what we pay. If you don't want it, you don't want to be here. But in the meantime, we're going to cancel flights. So neither side has really come up with a good balance anywhere. And it's a problem that is going to get worse because of what you just mentioned right at the end there, Max, that there are a lot of kids that are just saying, I'm not doing this. I'm not taking on that kind of debt for a really low paying job. And I don't even know how long I'll be there. It could take me the rest of my life to pay off my loans. The demand isn't as high as it used to be. So it's going to get worse. It really is, I think.
Well, one of the things they mentioned on the, I think on the Aviation Week podcast, it might have been in the article, but I'm pretty sure it was in the audio podcast, was the demand in China. And they were saying that if you can go over to China and sign on over there with one of the carriers as a pilot, you can earn $300,000 a year, unless you want to go and work a month and then go home for a month and then work a month and alternate like that. And then they'll only pay you about $200,000 a year. That's going to be pretty attractive to a lot of people. And I think that would just sort of, you know, drain away more pilots.
Well, it will, except that there are certainly licensing issues that you have to deal with. Even for people, I mean, years ago, 20 years ago, it was very common when I flew to see someone from Australia, New Zealand, Germany, England, Ireland, you name it. And they were all flying with American corporations and airlines, and because it was really easy to come over here and get your licenses translated to something the FAA would recognize. It's not quite so easy going the other way from here to Europe, trying to get your licenses redone with the EASA. I hear it is no piece of cake when you're trying to go to somewhere in the Far East, into Asia. But of course, it means you still have to have the experience already. And there are a lot of these people that are furloughed right now that say, I don't have a job and I don't have the money to fund my changeover of licenses, even though the money may be better. And then, of course, there are going to be those people that don't want to move anyhow. But, you know, I just wanted to add one quick thing because I had it at the end of the show notes here. But since we had a listener, Rick, who made a comment about that piece I did a couple of weeks ago on why the pay at the regional airlines is so lousy. And I just want to read it here real quick because it's short and it's right in the subject matter we're talking about here. He said, Rob, you know, I'm curious what regional pilots you talked to before you did that Aviation Minute, because it appears to me as a regional pilot that representation by the unions here was really lacking at the regional level. The Envoy guys, because that's who I was talking about, the carrier that used to be American Eagle, the Envoy guys were sold down the tubes by ALPA. American took away any new aircraft from them and gave them to the likes of carriers like PSA. So he said, I did like your comparison about the CFI part, though. That was pretty cool. Well, anyway, I didn't have to say that, but
for completeness.
But I think, you know, it is an important part that I think Rick mentioned that, you know, the airlines don't just produce the contract. The employees produce the contract with the union, and somehow, you know, ALPA convinced the guys at Envoy or some of both that this was the best deal they could get, and they took a pay freeze for 10 years. And guess what? That's why the pay's not going to get any better there.
It's kind of locked in, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's absolutely locked in. At the same time, when the mainline American guys grant you different union, but the mainline American guys got a 23% pay raise.
Travis, do you have unions of employees at the airport?
That's a great question. The labor that works for the airport authority is not unionized, but that's a small fraction of the folks in that airport. We call it the community. Airport community every day. There are about 175 employees of the airport authority, and that includes full and part-time. And then we have a variety, the carriers that are based in Knoxville, US Air, Delta, Allegiant, etc. it depends on who they have a contract with. So it may be American Eagle, which is the ground handling contractor for actually United Express at our station, or US Air may have organic US Air employees, and they are unionized. So it depends on who has which contract.
Okay. Just a final news item. Rob, I see that you were on CNBC with Andrea James on drones.
Yeah, I just had to throw it in there. And Travis, if you're a longtime listener, you know that Max and David are just drone geeks. So every time I have a chance to anti-drone them, I just like to drone on. And but actually, this week was very special. Actually, I should say last week was very special, because on Sunday morning, the FAA, 11:30 in the morning on a Sunday, released the details of its proposed rulemaking for drones. And there's probably no better way to normally make a story disappear than to release it on a Sunday morning. And the only thing that would have been better would have been the day before a federal holiday, which I think it was.
It was,
actually.
Wasn't it? Monday
yeah.
was a holiday.
You're
so
right.
So it does kind of make you wonder about that whole thing. But yeah. So it was kind of interesting, and they grabbed me and this lady who's a financial analyst, a banker, and I thought, what in the world am I going to talk about on related to drones with this banking lady? But she was talking about the economics of drones, which I couldn't argue with, and I still don't. They just have not dealt with the aspect of the detect and avoid technology that's going to keep those things out of our faces. And that's still a long way off.
Travis, we've seen many, many reports of people flying their quadcopters close to airports, close to airliners approaching or departing airports. Is that an issue that you've seen in Knoxville?
It is not an issue that we have seen in Knoxville. I've had some dialogue. We are in East Tennessee, next to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and also the Cherokee National Forest. And I have fielded some calls and inquiries from timber contractors and some mapping organizations concerning the National Forest. It was land management and forestry management type issues. That's honestly the only dialogue that we've had so far. I will make an interesting note. We actually participated in a test program where we submitted our plan and our credentials to deal with a UAV. I think the Navy and the Navy was looking for Air Force or joint use military installations where they could pre-plan and safely land a UAV that was en route from one location to another, and they wanted to pre-arrange safe havens or airports that could understand how to deal with a UAV that paid an unplanned visit.
So it must be a topic that you kind of watch out of the corner of your eye, maybe, in terms of the safety implications of the regulations that the FAA ends up with.
Yeah, for the airport operator perspective, it fits kind of neatly in with some other issues that we're normally watching anyway, which are permits for fires around an airport, or erecting cranes, or new cell phone towers, or any kind of construction that would either have an impact or perhaps even conflict with what's called FAA regulations Part 77, which is the airspace issues around an airport to make sure you don't get obstructions in the approaches.
Again, we're speaking with Travis Gardner. He's the Vice President of Operations for the Metropolitan Knoxville Airport Authority. Again, Travis, welcome to the show.
Kind thanks for the warm greeting.
Now, can you tell us what's the typical day in your life at the office? What kinds of issues come up? What are the things that keep you up at night, or the thrills that you get in your sort of day-to-day job?
Well, the past week has been quite a bit of an anomaly. It has been unusual in that it has been winter weather operations, but that is not typical. We're a bit, you know, we're in East Tennessee. We're a bit south of the snow belt. So it's not like, doesn't compare at all to Buffalo, New York, or the eastern side of Ohio that deals with lake effect snow. We're typically here, we're dealing with ice, frozen precipitation like that. And that's been a bit unusual. My normal day is my role with the Airport Authority. Is the chief operating officer, or the better title is vice president of operations. And, you know, there's people that ask me in everyday life, what do you do? And the best way that I can describe it is I'm the director of stuff. I don't have to collect the rent, and I don't have to do the sales and marketing. And we have an airport engineer, so I don't have to build things, but I'm kind of the landlord. So anything dealing with daily operations, making sure the airport is safe to operate commercial aircraft in and out of, that is my role. The FAA issues, I use the term, it's the driver's license. Just like you need to be legal on the road with a car, an airport for a commercial carrier needs to be legal. So the FAA issues what's called your operating certificate. Kind of like the analogy of a pilot's license. And it says to the world that this airport is safe for air carrier operations on aircraft that, you know, basically if it weighs more than 12,500 pounds and operates scheduled service, there's a higher standard and a higher expectation that an airport has some safety programs in place. And also some procedures and equipment in place should anything happen. So that's my job every day, is to make sure that the airport is safe and ready to operate. And a lot of that could be just described as maintenance and care. So I do direct a workforce of airport maintainers, and these are kind of the like a city public works department. We've got two 9,000-foot runways that are 150 feet wide, and a taxiway network, and, of course, aircraft parking aprons. And so that amounts to almost 7 million square yards of pavement to deal with and make sure that it's cared for. And it's honestly very dynamic. In the summertime, when you have a thunderstorm move through and lightning activity, you can wind up with one minute there's a nice clean stretch of pavement, and next minute there's a hole that's maybe a foot in the diameter and it's 8 or 10 feet deep, where a lightning strike just took place and it evaporates the pavement. So there's a constant process of inspection, I've got folks that are eyes and ears that are constantly looking at that airfield environment to make sure it's safe from any kind of change like that. It could be wind that blows FOD out onto the runways or taxiways. It could be a flock of starlings, or in the fall, geese, migratory waterfowl, anything like that. There's 6,000 some light fixtures out there, taxiway edge lights, centerline lights, touchdown zone lights, rotating beacon, PAPIs, VASIs, all sorts of NAVA. You know, there's a wind cone. And so all those features make the airport safe for that aircraft to land and take off. And that's my role, is to make sure that our programs are robust and that the environment is safe.
How many square yards of pavement did you say you had?
About 6 million square yards.
And no snowplows.
Oh, yeah, we have several snowplows.
You have snowplows. Oh,
we actually have snowplows.
All right. Well, you said you were south of the snow belt. I just thought maybe you didn't have that stuff.
Oh, we do. We have a series of 20-foot snowplows and big plow trucks and pavement de-icers and snow blowers and all kinds of apparatus, but we're qualified and are capable, but it's not everyday business for us. We only get to crank up and get into snow operations three or four times a year.
Travis, when something occurs that impacts the safety of the airport in a way that causes the airport to be shut down or flights to be paused or whatever, how is that decision made? Is it does everybody look to you, for example, or are there processes in place so that different people can, you know, kind of raise the red flag and say, you know, tilt, everybody stop?
Yeah, it's a combination of it. We have procedures. Those are all described in something called an airport certification manual. And it's a binder that's 3 or 4 inches thick with checklist and procedures, and it's got an organizational chart of anyone that I've delegated particular authority to. A good example would be we've got about 10 people with the authority to issue a NOTAM. So a good example would be there is a there's runway hold short markings. So you've got a pilot that's on a taxiway, comes up to a stop bar, and there's a sign. It's a mandatory sign. It must be lit. And if it's not lit, we do not comply with standards. So if the bulb is out or the circuit is bad, then we issue a NOTAM that says we have a non-standard condition. Take caution. The light is out that tells you that you're about to enter the runway environment. And so that's an example of we have about 10 different people that can issue that NOTAM. And then there's a whole list of people that are inspecting the airfield. The absolute minimum is sometime within a couple of hours of daylight every day, there is an exhaustive inspection using these rigorous checklists. It's not unlike a pre-flight inspection on an aircraft. It can take 45 minutes to 2 hours. It depends on what kind of activity is going on. If you've got construction activity on the airport, then obviously the inspection takes longer, or you may have wildlife and you get your inspection interrupted because you saw a flock of starlings. So you're going to get the pyrotechnics gun out and fire some noisemaker to scare off the starlings or something like that. And it might take as long as 2 hours to complete that inspection. And then in the evening, just after dusk, there will be a nighttime inspection. And you can honestly, there's things that you can see during the daylight that you can't see at night, obviously. And there's things at night that you can't see during the daylight, like a taxiway guidance sign. If the panel is delaminating or it's cracked, you can see that at night with the lighting in the background, and you can't see during the day. And then anytime there's any significant event, like you might have a gear-up landing, or you may have an aircraft that lands with a hydraulic failure. You might have an aircraft that lands with hot brakes. So you have your airport your ARF department, aircraft rescue and firefighting, they roll the trucks out. So you're also doing an inspection anytime there's any sort of anomaly in operation or any kind of thunderstorm, any kind of significant event. So at a minimum, the airfield's getting this very close detailed look twice a day, but three or four times a week, there might be one, there might be four additional inspections that day.
Do you have more than one ARF station on the field?
We actually do. We have an ARF station that is co-located with the civilian passenger terminal, and then we have an ARF station that is located on the military side. We are host for the Tennessee Air National Guard. They have a air refueling wing with KC-135R models, and they have dedicated ARF facilities there. Kind of one of our notes of trivia for McGee Tyson Airport is we have more ARF capability with the two entities combined than Chicago O'Hare does.
So you have well, this is going to probably sound like a stupid question, but that if you have more than one, does that make them ARF facilities? ARF? Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Travis.
That wasn't fair. For a bad
I should have told you that was coming. That was cruel. I'm sorry. No, that's interesting though. I didn't realize you had. But then that changes things when you have a joint use facility, doesn't it?
It does. The military members, of course, they've also got a military mission. So they have a training requirement. They also have deployment requirements. So they may rotate firefighters in and out of that facility to meet their deployment requirements. And then commensurately, they would lean on us. There's something called an index, and that is a statement that the airport is ready to respond with firefighters and ARF apparatus 24/7, 365. So we also have those civilian fire resources, and so occasionally there are requests from other fire departments in the area. It's rarely an aircraft incident offsite, but we could be called to perhaps a brush fire or a very large structural fire, or we're very well equipped to deal with large hydrocarbon fires. So if there's a tanker truck that's, spilled or on fire on the interstate, maybe the civilian fire department in that jurisdiction could call on us to support them with our ARF equipment. And so we would ask the military component to pick up what I refer to as that ARF index, or that capability to respond on an airport incident. Hmm.
Travis, can you tell us a little bit about your career path to get to this position?
Sure. I actually started out in the Air Force. I was enlisted, and you've seen, Top Gun and all those movies with there's an arresting cable on the aircraft carrier deck. Well, I did that same job in the Air Force. It's kind of a little known fact that the Air Force, anytime there's fighter aircraft, also has arresting gear installed on their runways. So if there's a hydraulic failure or battle damage to an aircraft, they can minimize any damage to that landing aircraft. The other one is you can, with aerial refueling, you can take an F-16, an F-15, any of those tactical air-to-mud aircraft, and you can load them up with armaments, put all the iron on them, and a minimal fuel load, and that gives you the choice of using a 2,000, a 3,000, a 4,000-foot runway instead of a 10,000-foot runway. And then after you get it in the air, then you put gas on it. So I was one of the guys that installed and took care of the Air Force arresting gear. So that started my aviation career. I was enlisted for about 13 or 14 years before I was commissioned as an officer. So I've always been in a role of supporting aviation facilities in one way or the other with various jobs. I was a transportation officer, and at one point a fuels officer, and I was a land surveyor when I was enlisted, all those kinds of things that took to support an airbase or the facilities side of an airbase. And that's what kind of launched my career. Most of my military time was as a reservist. So simultaneously, I started out as a land surveyor for the Knoxville Airport when they were doing a runway extension, and did airport engineering for about 8 years before I moved into operations. And my move into operations was really, I was the maintenance manager. So all the pavement maintenance and fence, you have an air operations area, there's miles of fencing surrounding most airports, and runway lights and taxiway lights and nav aids, and there's buildings with roofs, and there's sewer systems and water systems and electrical distribution systems. So I was the maintenance manager before moving into the senior role in operations.
It's too bad that David's not here, because his dad was a base guy in the Air Force, and I don't mean his personality, I mean what he managed, and so. But two, it's too bad David's not here, because we were going to talk about the Smoky Mountain Air Show, which is part military, and I wouldn't even know what questions to ask. I mean, it's just too bad David's not here, you know? Don't you think, Max?
Yeah, it is kind of a shame.
So this is where you want me to chime in?
Oh, wow! Jeez, it's David!
Hi, David.
Wow, where did you come from?
I've been here the whole time. You just guys don't let me have a word in edgewise.
What was your dad's job on the bases, David?
He was base civil engineer. He was the highest ranking civilian at Willow Grove for the Air Force. We had a 130 mission.
I have been to Willow Grove.
If you've been to the Afri's end of the base, now that it no longer exists, that was dad's toy.
Oh, yeah, I've been there. That was after they had converted. I think they were an A-10 unit at the time I was there.
That was the Air National Guards, but they were co-located with the 913th. Yeah, the facility actually was an Air Force Reserve facility, and it, quote, was adjacent to the Naval Air Station. They shared a runway, even though if you listen to everybody else, it was all one base. But and then the Air National Guard rented space and now owns the facility that was owned by the Air Force Reserve.
Ah, interesting.
So, but we, Travis, we've got to hear about this. Tell us about this Smoky Mountain Air Show.
That's right. We're pretty excited about it. We have a long history of hosting air shows in Knoxville. We were on from the late 80s through the 90s up until 2000, we were on a 2 or 3 year rotation of hosting the Navy Blue Angels and the Air Force Thunderbirds. And, then the last show that we hosted was in 2000, and we had another one planned for the spring of 2002. Of course, the events of September the 11th, 2001, gave us a significant moment of pause, and we could not really figure out how to cope with all the security demands. That was one issue, and the second issue is the air show had been hosted as an open house by the Air National Guard. So they would, we would put 180, 200,000 people on their aircraft parking ramp for a 3-day air show. And so we, in fits and starts, we continue to try to plan an air show. And most of the folks that from the airbase involved in the leadership, including myself, we'd all retired. And about 2011, 2012, we tried to rekindle the vision of hosting another air show, and we made some preparations. And about the time we got the train on the tracks, sequestration was announced, and it turned the air show community and the air show industry upside down. And we kind of waited and watched. And about a year ago, ICAS, which is the International Council of Air Show, was successful in basically learning how to cope and reorganizing the air show industry on the tail of sequestration. We formed a partnership between 5 local government agencies, including the Tennessee Air National Guard, the Metropolitan Knoxville Airport Authority, the neighboring county, which is Knox County, their mayor's administration, the neighboring city, which is the city of Knoxville, and the city administration, as well as Blount County, which is actually where the airport is located, all went into partnership and said it's important enough to us for tourism development and economic development that we want to bring an air show back to East Tennessee. And to the letter, they all said we're willing to put our money where our mouth is. So we basically formed an air show partnership among 5 government agencies, and each agency is going to contribute some funds for the startup cost, all those costs up front that we'll have to use to secure acts and rent porta potties and have a contract with an air show announcer, all those kind of financial dealings. And so last June, we submitted an application to the U.S. Navy Blue Angels. And it's kind of unique. You fill out your application and you get it approved, and you have to, there's all sorts of airport sponsor commitments and FAA coordination. Well, you may find this hard to believe, but the FAA is really kind of picky about the dealings at an air show.
I bet.
They want to make sure they're safe. And so there's a lot of front-end coordination. We submitted the application, and then it turns into industrial espionage or a military secret about where the military acts are going to perform the following years. Now, the Air Force, as I understand it currently, they announce a one-year schedule, and the Blue Angels announce a two-year schedule. So we literally waited 6 months, I believe, until December the 6th. There is the ICAS convention. It's held, and basically the aviation press and the airport communities and the air show industry waits with bated breath, and they flash the schedule for the next 2 years up on the screen. And that's when you find out if you got the Blues, the Thunderbirds, or the Snowbirds from Canada at your air show. And then that you have to wait until that happens for the rest of the pieces to fall in place. So we took a coalition of the willing out to the ICAS convention, and we got to celebrate. We got to see the Smoky Mountain Air Show was announced for basically a year from now. It will be April the 15th, 16th, and 17th of 2016. So we're about 14 months away. I will say, I had experience dealing with the air show, but it's been 15 years ago, and our marketing and sales folks and public relations were wanting to put together a plan to do a press announcement. And I said, don't worry about it. If this is announced, we'll have at least a week to get a plan together and make an announcement. And I could not have been more wrong. It was less than 24 hours. The Pensacola newspaper carried the Blue Angels schedule for the year, and Twitter and Facebook immediately lit up, and we were behind the power curve on announcing that air show for the Knoxville community.
And Travis, there's a website, isn't there, for the air show that folks can go to learn more?
Yes, absolutely. It is SmokyMountainAirShow.com, and that's SMOKY. MountainAirShow.com, where you can find out all the details. We have there's a dedicated Twitter feed on there now, and a page on Facebook. And I actually pushed some stuff out this evening as I was on the elevator leaving work today. The Blue Angels had pushed a video out of, I think, their number four ship, one of their demonstration acts. So I was getting some Facebook likes as I prepared to talk on the show tonight.
And how about the airports that you're associated with or the authority? Where can folks go to learn more about that? Or are they in social media as well?
Oh, absolutely. We're a bit of a geographical oddity, you might say. We're an airport of choice. We set about 2.5-3 hours away from Nashville, which is a Southwest hub, or Southwest city, and Atlanta. Now, if you're trying to compete for airfares and air service with Atlanta and a Southwest city, it's not the easiest thing to do. So we, by necessity, are engaged with our community, which in the airport industry is called a catchment area, to make sure that we're the airport of choice, because you have to choose to use Knoxville. We don't have the direct destinations that either Nashville or Atlanta do, so we have to make it an easy choice for our customers. And social media is one of the ways that we do that. Our Twitter handle is actually at Fly Knoxville, and our website is flyknoxville.com.
All right. Very good. Travis, this has been a fascinating conversation. I know there's a lot of other topics that we could talk about, but we're a little bit pressed for time, and so we need to push on. But we'd really like to thank you so much again for coming on the show.
Absolutely. It was a real pleasure, and the air show is consuming and will consume an enormous amount of time and planning resources as time goes on. And I'd just like to make the offer, if you all want to follow or track progress of planning an air show, or you know what, I'll just make an open invitation. If the airplane geeks would like to come to Knoxville and watch an air show, we'll give you ample opportunity to get a good sunburn in April of 2016.
Sounds like a plan. I love it. All right. Thanks again, Travis.
Yeah, thanks, Travis. I'll go.
And now we're pleased to have David Vanderhoof bring us a movie of the month.
Thanks, Max. First, let me say thank you to all the listeners who have sent well wishes. I'm touched, and it has brightened my spirits in a rough and trying time right now. I'd also like to thank Jamie for keeping the history segment going in my absence. I unfortunately still have a long way to go, but enough said about that. Airplane Geek's in-flight movie of the month, Flight of the Intruder, selected by you folks. Lightning never strikes twice. Flight of the Intruder is an example of that. The U.S. Navy wanted another Top Gun, except this time for the attack crews. Stephen Kuntz's novel of the same name was converted to a screenplay. Paramount Pictures received full cooperation from the Navy. This shows in the movie. There's attention to geek detail that doesn't often come in these kind of movies. But first, let's get the bad stuff out of the way. This isn't a great movie. To quote the professor in the house, it's disjointed, obnoxious, and really out of date with really bad audio. I'll credit the last part to my old DVD playing on a modern Blu-ray system. The characters are really caricatures. You never really feel sorry for Brad Johnson's Grafton. He's supposed to be so devastated, but I think you feel more about Maverick's loss of Goose than you ever do about Grafton's loss. The only scene you might feel a wince of pain is at the end of the Follow My Leader scene, where he inadvertently says, "Are we having fun now, huh, Mug?" Like last month's review of Always, Johnson is asked to play a romantic lead, this time played to Rosanna Arquette's Callie. It's just bad. I seriously wished I could afford to through it to get back to the flying. So how about the other two leads that actually got top billing? Danny Glover does a good job playing Danny Glover. If you want to see a good airplane movie with Glover, go watch Bat 21. Defoe's Cole is creepy, but he does get to be the hero in the end. But then again, Willem's best character is Willem Dafoe. So the movie has the formula. A pilot who needs to come to terms with the loss of a friend, an obnoxious commanding officer, a boys will be boys scene and bar scene, redemption of the hero, and of course, a blonde love interest. Yet it fails. But where does it succeed? Oh, those beautiful, sexy A6s. Why watch this movie? The flying. The A6 was a hell of an aircraft, and VA-165 boomers wanted to show that what the Intruder could do. The nice thing was externally the A6Es that 165 had did not have the tram turret under their nose, and they were repainted in Vietnam-era VA-196 markings. The movie was made at the right time. We were still flying Vietnam-era aircraft, and we could do it off a Vietnam-era aircraft carrier. The models aren't so good, but the Iron Hand mission is not something most people know about, and Cole's description of the B as, quote, some additional black boxes in their mind, unquote, is true. Also operating at night and don't watch the flash. It does take guts to get shot at and so you can shoot back. The Follow the Leader scene is fun. It shows how maneuverable the Intruder was. It operated just above the trees below the radar, a wild ride. The strike on Sam City, I will admit, is kind of lame. A nice touch, though, is the failure of Diane, the digital integrated attack and navigation equipment. And the manual did say, kick it, until the rotor started again. All along, you see a NAM area ship, the Independence. Take some time to see the effort they put into it. There are real Phantoms on the deck behind, the A-70 Corsairs on the cats for the Alpha Strike, while Light and Dark Ghost Gray did get full-color insignias adding to the illusion. There are A-6s being serviced on the hangar deck. It is 1972 again. Then there's the Alpha Strike. For those who aren't familiar with the term Alpha Strike means you launch the whole air wing as a package, fighters, attackers, and bombers. Thus, in the movie, you see them launching A-7s as well as A-6s. The Phantoms would have launched first. With the crash of Devil 501 and Devil 505, the show-stealing SPADs come in. Why do I love this movie? It's all about the SPADs, and napalm. I remember seeing that first Sky Raider come in the movie theater. I scream for joy. The Sandy mission is one of my favorites, and the two SPADs ripping up the Rife Paddies makes me happy. I can watch that again and again. So truth be told, I watch it for the SPADs. So you know I pay attention. Some nitpicks. There's no such thing as a 1,000-pound snake eye, only 500-pounders. They call the ASH-3 in the movie an HH-3 Jolly Green Giant. It's black, but it is Navy. Oh, and the ZSU-23 tank that with the four-barrel gun was never used in Vietnam. It came to use in the 1973 Yom Kippur War. So, it's not a good movie. It has its moments. So remember, the lights are much brighter there when you go downtown. But it does have a pair of Spads that drop their tanks on the targets, causing large balls of fire. That, to me, is worth owning it and occasionally revisiting it. But not enough to get it over the hurdle. So Flight of the Intruder gets 2 out of 5 props for me. So this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks movie critic, signing off.
Wow, that was great, David. But I have to ask you a question. If I was sitting next to you in a movie theater watching a movie like this, would you drive all of us crazy? Would we have to listen to, you know, that's not right. This was blue, not green, or...
No, I have enough restraint to wait till after the movie.
Oh, okay.
No, because I and my buddies, well, when I saw Flight of the Intruder in 1991, I saw it with quite a few Marines, two of which actually worked on A6 Intruders in Vietnam, and they lambasted the thing at the end of the movie. But the flying in it is very good. I mean, it's not quite Top Gun, but it is very good. And it is worth fast-forwarding all the crappy parts to see the flying. And the two Warbird Spads at the end of the movie are just amazing. Low-level, guns blazing. It's just pure joy for a geek like me.
So when you say Spads, what are you talking about?
A Spad is the term for a A1 Sky Raider, which was a single-engined, large attack aircraft that actually... for most part, the A6 replaced. It was the bomb truck. But in the Vietnam era, the Air Force started flying them in what they call a Sandy mission, which was the recovery of pilots. And the A1 was the A10 Thunderbolt of the day. It flew low. It flew slow. It had a large wing, carried lots and lots of bombs, napalm, and had lots of guns, and could fly around the pilots, keep the guys at bay until the helicopters came.
All right, David, thanks so much for that. So we'll look forward to another movie of the month, another in-flight movie of the month in March, I guess, won't we?
Yeah, I haven't quite picked it out yet. So why don't everybody send their suggestions into thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and maybe we'll pick one.
Thanks for dropping in. We really appreciate it. It's good to hear your voice again, David.
Well, it's great to be back, even if it's just a short minute. So I miss you guys, but... I'm doing the best I can to get back as soon as I can. So we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye, David.
Bye, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 22nd of February, 2015, and I think I'm feeling the mists of Avalon, dude.
Absolutely, and welcome, folks, to the Australia Desk for episode 338. Yes, Grant, you're exactly right. We're right on the eve of Avalon 2015, the Australian International Air Show. Only rolls around every 2 years for us, so yeah, we have every right to get excited, I think.
Yeah, I think so. There's been a lot of talk about, oh dear, here comes Avalon, it's the same old, and yeah, while there is some similarities in a lot of the areas, there's a lot of very interesting new stuff there, not just the A400M from Airbus, the Grizzly, the load lifter that sits between the C-130 and the C-17. That's going to be there. I'm looking forward to seeing that. There's going to be a really good presence of World War One aircraft, primarily from the Vintage Aviator in New Zealand, and the guys up in Queensland that we've had on the show with some of their replicas. I'm looking forward to catching up with them. And perhaps the biggest news is something that dropped on us over the weekend, which is that an RQ-4 Global Hawk has flown into Avalon. It actually, it's the first time that a Global Hawk has flown into a civilian airfield and also into an air show. Admittedly, the air show wasn't happening at the time. It landed on Saturday night, but it's there, it's parked, and I'm kind of keen to go and have a chat. I've seen the mock-ups of one, but I've never seen the real thing, and I'm looking forward to having a chat with a few people about them.
It's an interesting terminology you used there, Grant. That was a little unfortunate, actually. Dropped onto us. I think that's the very point that they're trying to say won't happen.
Yeah, well, no, there is that. So,
geez, I crack myself up. Well, of course, you know, actually, that's good because we can probably do a report for the UAV Digest, Grant, and, you know, invade yet another podcast.
Yeah, it's not quite a quadcopter, but hey, look at this. It's about the size of a 737, apparently. But anyhow, no, I think it's a bit smaller than that, but it's got the wingspan of one. Yeah, they had to work with new procedures between the RAF and civilian air traffic control to allow the remotely piloted aircraft, such as the RQ-4, to operate in civil airspace. So this was pretty cool. And as they're saying, it's paving the way for Australia's newly acquired MQ-4C Triton that's going to work with our P-8A Poseidons when they come online as well.
Yeah, so that's right. In fact, the government's saying here that they've purchased about seven of these Triton.
Up to seven.
Well, up to seven. There you go. So, of course, that's a lot of you know, elections away, but at least that's what they're saying at the moment, Grant. And so I suppose the air traffic controllers and everybody else here better get used to it because whether we like it or not, UAVs are the way of the future, it seems.
Indeed, indeed. They're not going to replace manned aircraft entirely, but they're going to take over from a number of the areas that either we can't keep men up there long enough or the guys get bored. You know, just orbiting the same place for hours and hours and days and days.
Well, I can guarantee you, Grant, that they wouldn't get bored if they were flying an A400M. That's what I'm going to Avalon for this year. You know, Grant, it reminds me of that time I flew in that Hercules all those years ago.
I'm going
to
smack you through the Skype connection so hard. No, I'm actually the other reason for going is meeting up with everyone and spending a little bit of time in the trade halls and so on and looking for some of the different kind of things and catching up with people I haven't seen for ages. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to all that.
Yep. Now, we're going to have a little bit of a different coverage this year. Normally, we do a daily coverage. Well, unfortunately, we're a little bit stretched this year, but we're hoping to put out at least two shows. So, look forward in the Plane Crazy Down Under feed next week. We should have one while the show is on. And, well, actually, Grant, I guess by the time this show airs, it'll be this week, but we should have one while the air shows on and one the week following. So, you know, we always say when we're going to do an Avalon coverage, you know, we've done it. What will we do, Grant? But once we get there never seems to be any shortage of content for us. So, should be another big week.
Meanwhile, mate, speaking of big events and things like that, well after Avalon and into March, right about the time I'll probably be in Canberra for the ballooning fiesta, we've got the final flight for OJA, the 747-400 from Qantas that we were talking about recently.
Yeah, we were talking about it, and that's on the Labor Day long weekend, in fact, coming up. So that's all been confirmed now. So Oscar Juliet Alpha, it'll be making its final flight from Sydney, a very short flight, in fact, down to Wollongong to the Illawarra Regional Airport, where it will land and will presumably never fly again. So if you're going to be around, folks, if you've been looking for the date and for some reason you've been living under a rock perhaps and you haven't caught up with all the information coming out from the Historical Aircraft Restoration Society, a.k.a. HARS, so there it is. It's the 8th of March. And I don't know if either of us will be able to get up there for that, which is disappointing, Grant, but we'll have to send somebody from our team along. I think that's going to be a really historic occasion. And boy, I tell you what, Grant, it's a reasonable-sized airfield there at the Illawarra Regional Airport. We've been there a few times, but I tell you what, I reckon it's going to be dwarfed a bit by having that 747 sitting in there. It'll be awesome.
I suspect you may be right. And like I said last time, I'm not sure where they're going to find space to park it. But those HARS boys, they're pretty serious about what they do. And I'm sure they'll make room.
You know, what would be really cool, Grant, is if they actually painted OJA up in a nice retro theme. That seems to be all the rage. But I guess that's not for every airline in the world. And particularly Air New Zealand, our cousins across the Tasman there, they've come out recently and said, nope, we don't care how much everybody else, every other airline's doing it. We're not going to be painting any of our aircraft in any retro themes.
That's right, mate. There was some thought that their next 787-9 Zulu Kilo - November Zulu Charlie was to arrive in retro livery with the classic blue and green stripe 1973 to 1996 version, the one that I grew up with. And what's really interesting is that if they had have done it, it's November 789 Echo X-Ray, which is the 787-9 that gave that really, you know, spirited performance at the 2014 Farnborough International Air Show. So they've got to repaint it anyhow because that's in Boeing house colours. So it's got to go to Air New Zealand. So I'm kind of surprised they didn't actually do it.
That is interesting, Grant. According to Jodie Williams, the head of global brand management for Air New Zealand, in this article here in australianaviation.com.au, she says they did consider it, but did say that they're in the throes right now of a brand new livery area of black and white, the black and white fern, and so they're already committed to ensuring that they upgrade their existing aircraft in the new paint scheme. I suppose it would send a rather confused message, but then again, Grant, they have so many themed, you know, Hobbit-themed aircraft flying around our skies at the moment, it's really hard to pick anyway. I said to you before we started recording this, what really is normal for Air New Zealand? Because all of their jets just have these really interesting paint schemes all over them, I reckon.
No, well, they've got the two Hobbit franchise paint schemes, one with the Hobbits and Dwarves, and the other with Smaug on it, and they've got a few in all-black livery, where the aircraft's entirely black, including the airline's first 787-9 Dreamliner. It's an all-black paint, but it's not the all-black version, but most of their aircraft now are being repainted to have a white body. The empennage is black, so the last fifth of the fuselage is black with a white fern on it, and then the tail is black with the white koru on it.
Well, I got to say, Grant, if you compare it to the you know, sort of the green and blue and white scheme, it looks sensational, I must say. So, yeah, actually, I'm supportive of that. I did notice, interestingly, recently that Lufthansa rolled out a 747-8i in a retro livery, and that looked pretty cool, actually, but no, I don't think the retro Air New Zealand one. It looks a bit daggy, to be honest with you. Well, we can't wrap up this report without first talking about the Red Bull Air Race. So fantastic. Kicked off in Abu Dhabi a week or so back. And great news, Grant. Well, great news if you're Australian. Matt Hall came second.
Woohoo! Go, Matt. Yay.
A really good result. And I'll tell you what, Grant, he only came second to Britain's Paul Bonhomme by 0.084 of 1 second. Let's hear what Matt had to say about that.
Yeah, happy to be on the podium, but to be that close is kind of frustrating. We flew a really good plan today. We apart from my pylon hit, I flew exactly the times and the lines I was hoping. So to miss by 0.008 of a second at the end, you know, that's like about a metre or so of aircraft length. So the winglets definitely are what's giving us that edge. So typically last year we're always hanging about half a second off the pace with those guys. I've now got capacity, and I think we've got room to move with them as well, because we still don't know which areas the maximum advantage is that I can target. So we're just trying to fly smoothly and let the winglets do their job, but we can do more. Well, I wouldn't say it's a warning, but I think I can get more out of the plane, so they can get more out of their planes as well. So we'll see what happens in Japan.
And that audio courtesy of the Red Bull Air Race content pool. And I tell you what, Grant, his MXSR is looking fantastic now. He's taken a leaf out of Nigel Lamb's book, and he's got some really, really groovy-looking winglets on that aircraft. And yeah, he's saying they're experimental. I'm tipping they're here to stay.
Yeah, well, they may tweak them a little bit more, but after what we've seen at the start of the season, I doubt he'll be taking them off.
Mind you, Grant, the next race is about 3 months away, so if he's going to do some tweaking, he's got plenty of time to do that.
No, that's handy to know. Maybe I can win Lotto in that time and finally get to see a Red Bull Air Race. I've never seen one.
It's in Japan, I think, so maybe we should head over there. We need a holiday, Grant. We work too hard.
I know. Well, you do.
I work for the railways.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to say it.
Well, enough lamenting for this week. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
See you at Avalon.
Yeah, the next Red Bull Air Race is in Japan. It's May 16th and 17th. And, you know, Rob, if you visit their website, redbullairrace.com, they have a lot of photos, a lot of videos, lots of information about the air races. Really exciting stuff.
It's kind of interesting, actually, when we think about the fact that just a couple of years ago, it was the sequestration thing and air shows were gone. And now look at the air shows we're talking about tonight.
Yeah.
It's pretty exciting.
It is exciting. All right. Well, speaking of exciting, we have an aviation minute from Rob, and here it is.
From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark, and this is the Aviation Minute. If you missed last week's episode of the Airplane Geek Show, you also missed the discussion Brian Coleman, our assistant producer, started about frequent flyer programs. He mentioned that Southwest Airlines had recently changed its rapid reward system, something I knew about from the letter they sent me. So, first of all, a bias alert. I need to mention that I'm a longtime Southwest customer, a fact that has nothing to do with the photo I have in my office of the airline's founder, Herb Kelleher, and I having a glass of wild turkey when I was lucky enough to meet him many years back. Everybody at the show seemed pretty concerned about those frequent flyer changes. The changes mean a free flight costs more than it used to. A free flight costs more. There's a contradiction for you. Well, my only comment, though, was, well, so what?
The fact that Southwest took this long to tweak their program to better reflect the price of the ticket was actually the surprise to me, not that they did it. Even though I have to drive cross town to Midway to connect with Southwest, I do it as often as I can, but not because of the free tickets. I just like Southwest service. To me, the free tickets are gravy, and I don't fly business select either. I'm in the back with everybody else. But of course, Brian Coleman just couldn't stop himself last week. A couple of days after the show, he just had to share a post from our buddy Brent Snyder over at the Cranky Flyer. That's Cranky Flyer, FLIER.com, by the way. Brett makes airline economics look pretty easy, as you'll see if you have a chance to read his February 19th story about Southwest. So maybe I'm a minority, even when the guy who cuts my hair started asking me for advice on how to best travel using his frequent flyer points. Ugh. One thing that keeps me centered when people start griping about free flights is remembering that Bob Crandall created American's Advantage program in 1981 as a way to retain customers. All the other airlines, of course, quickly copied the program. 35 years later, though, those airlines would love to dump those loyalty programs if they could, because they're a ton of extra work for very little return on the part of the airlines. But we're a generation of flyers addicted to free flights, so the airlines are probably stuck with these things, I think. But just because the airlines are stuck with these frequent flyer white elephants doesn't mean the airlines aren't going to continue trying to tweak them. But most importantly, there's absolutely nothing that passengers can do about any of this. Keep this in mind, though, as we all scuffle for those free tickets. We airline passengers, we really helped create this mess for ourselves. All the airlines did was deliver what their customers asked for, cheap tickets. So the seats are tight. There's no food. They lose our bags now and again, not to mention a host of new fees. We wanted cheap tickets. Well, we got them. The low-cost airlines that appeared after deregulation are what got people focused on price, by the way. Before deregulation, when all the airlines charged the same price, I actually thought the airlines were trying to create a sort of a cruise line kind of travel experience in the air. But post-deregulation passengers, the people chasing the cheapest ticket, well, they've helped turn that experience into something closer to traveling by Greyhound bus. So back to Southwest. To me, they're an airline that delivers a consistent system for boarding the airplanes. My bags ride free and the employees always seem pretty happy to see me. And no, I don't think Southwest is perfect. They've lost some of my bags along the way. But then honestly, they made good enough on it to keep me as a customer. Not all the airlines do that. That's life, I think. People screw up and companies screw up. It's how they handle the situation when they make a mistake, though, that's important to me. But then if I start talking about those kinds of situations too much, I'll end up stepping on Cranky Flyer's toes. And I don't want to make him any crankier than he already is. For now, though, I'm going to go see if I have a free ticket on Southwest. If not, I'm just going to wait until I do. There just seems to be so many more important things to worry about these days, I think. Like what Brian Coleman might have in store for me this week. From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark. We'll see you next time. Be sure and check out the Aviation Minute Archive at jetwine.com in case you want to catch up on any back episodes.
Wow, very interesting minute, Rob.
It's too bad Brian wasn't here.
I know. Well, he will be back, and I think he'll have an opportunity to pose something else.
Well, I just had a razz him. And in fact, it's really funny because I was thinking about it after that session last week, and then when he sent me Brent's column, yeah. And then when I was getting my hair cut on Friday and the guy started in on me about how to get the best deal, I said, enough! I've got to talk about this!
Oh, dear. All right, well, before we wrap this up, just quickly, we received a voicemail from our faithful listener, Stephen Tornblum, and he had some comments on slimline seats on JetBlue, and also about the deplaning process we talked about. So let's give Stephen a few minutes.
Hey, good evening, guys. It's Stephen in California. Just driving home from work, listening to episode 334 and the new segment about the slimline seats that are being put in the airlines. I believe that we have those on our 321s, just JetBlue. And I actually find that they're more comfortable to sit in on a five-hour flight across country than the regular seats in our Airbus 320. The 321 also has 1 inch less seat pitch than the 320s, but I don't seem to notice it, and it could be the slimline seats, I don't know, but we still have 33.2 or 3 inches of seat pitch on the 321, so I'm good with that, even though I'm not a real tall person. The second thing was, you guys were talking about the deplaning process. There was an article you guys read. And at Long Beach, we actually deplane at board out of using both the front and the rear of the aircraft. The deplaning process actually goes pretty quick. And actually, you could say weight balance purposes, it also helps because that way you're basically emptying equal parts or equal front back at the same time instead of like at New York or Miami, a normal airport where the front of the airplane gets lighter because everybody's still in the back of the plane. The boarding process, I've had gate crews board a flight in less than 15 minutes with 150 people on it using the front and the rear, even with families with car seats and stuff. And deplaning, they've deplaned in less than 14 or 15 minutes on average. So it goes really quick. I can't say for, most airports in the U.S., but I know at Long Beach, it works really, really well. And I think we do the same thing in Palm Beach in Florida. Just wanted to let you know, about that. I'm going to get back to the rest of the episode. Take care.
All right. Thanks for that feedback, Stephen. Always good to hear from Stephen. Ian, we'll put some links in the show notes to some other items sent by other listeners. Morgan was flying around Northwest Montana and took some absolutely spectacular photographs from the plane. We'll put one or two of those in the show notes. Also, Dan sent us an interesting article titled "Flying Solo, Having One Pilot in the Cockpit Might Be Scarier Than Having None." Interesting article, so we'll put link to that in the show notes. Also, Mike sent us some articles following up on our conversation about where's the safest place to sit in an airplane. We've got three items that we'll put in the show notes. Thanks to Mike for those. And then Errol sent us this was a blog post at a well-known New Zealand spotters blog that's got a lot of really fantastic photos of C-17s and ski-equipped LC-130s. These are aircraft in support of operations in the Antarctic, and that follows up on our recent series from Juan. So with that, Rob, I think that'll bring this episode to a close.
Probably the right time, I'd say.
So we want to thank everyone for listening. This has been episode 338. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. You can send us email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Look for us on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio as well. So with that, opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
But since we've got a full schedule, why don't we get started right away with the aviation news? Are you guys ready?
Well, ready.
Ready, yeah.
Gosh, I forgot to plug in.
Chocks.
I forgot to plug it in. Wait a minute.
See, I don't think you should cut this part out, Max. I think you ought to leave this part in.
All right. Well, I plugged it in, so.
Okay. So we're ready.
And now I am, too.
Actually, one thing before you go.
Sure.
If we come down to the air show, can you learn us how to speak in Tennessean?
Yes, I can.
Oh, hot dog.
Yes, I can.
No, hot damn. Oh, okay. Yeah. I can do this.
If you're ready to fully dedicate yourself to that endeavor, then if there's a will, there's a way.
So those are all models, huh?
No. The only thing are models are the ones that are blow up.
Oh.
This week. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
See you at Avalon.
Woohoo!
Well, of course, unless you're in the States, in which case we won't see you at Avalon. Well, in fact, we've never seen any of you people before.
Get down here, you slackers.
I wonder what Max really looks like.
Pretty cool from all I've heard.
Did he tell you that?
No, his fan club did.
Yeah, right. Hey, do you think we need to get a new theme song?
Yes. You know, it's interesting you said that because I was just thinking about that the other day.
Okay. I was just wondering. Maybe we're not recording anymore, are we?
We're all.
So, I mean, if we said, boy, I wonder if any of our listeners have any suggestions for a new theme song, they won't know about this.
No, but if they did know about it, though, we would want to make the point that it needs to be something that's royalty-free. So that we don't get into.
So that means it can't come from the English, right?
That's right. Yeah. No English. You're right. No royalty.
Okay. All right. Right. Yes. Royalty free. Okay. Yes. Well, we can talk about that next week.
All right. Very good. Thanks, Rob.
But you know, it would be fun if we could get, you know, maybe we could have a contest or something. You know, for the best song.
I wonder if we have any artistic. I'm sure we have some musicians in the. In the crowd, we might even have some people that could compose something.
Well, it never hurts to ask.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but.